That's right. Hello, everyone. Thanks a lot for the invitation. This talk is going to be all about spectator fields, how they behave during cosmic inflation, and what kind of imprints they may have left both to the CMB and to the large-scale structure of the universe. But before I begin, let me ask you, how many of you know what isocurvature perturbations mean? Please raise your hand if you do. Roughly one half, I think, which is something that I expected. That's all right. Those of you who do not know what isocurvature perturbations are, bear with me. I'm going to discuss them in detail in due course. All right, so let's jump right into it. Let's start by discussing scalar field behavior in the sither space. When it comes to history of the universe, let's assume entirely standard history. First cosmic inflation, then reheating, which was probably rather prompt compared to the total history of the universe, and then followed by that, a hot Big Bang scenario as usual. Assume that there's a scalar field with a very simple Lagrangian, where my scalar field chi has a canonical kinetic term and some potential, which I here, just for simplicity, assume to be that of a free scalar field, so that I only have a mass term m squared chi squared. However, when it comes to inflation, let's assume that this field indeed is not the inflaton field, not the field that drives inflation, but a spectator field. And as Alex was telling us yesterday, if the field was light, that is, if the effective mass, the second derivative of the potential, here it's just the bare mass m, if it was small compared to the Hubble scale during inflation, the field acquired fluctuations during inflation, so that instead of lying at the minimum of its potential, it was indeed fluctuating about it. In one Hubble time during inflation, an average fluctuation is the size of the Hubble scale during inflation, and as the Hubble scale during inflation can be as high as roughly 10 to 14 GeV, these jumps during inflation could indeed have been rather huge. And one can then ask a question that if I place the field somewhere in its potential, anywhere, basically, it doesn't have to lie at the minimum of its potential, assume that it was lying at field value 1 Hubble scale at some point during inflation, while inflation was still ongoing, and ask that how, if at that point, in some Hubble patch, the field was rather homogeneous, so that you had a narrow distribution for field values in the universe in an inflating patch, how did that distribution evolve with time when inflation proceeded?
Are you going to talk about why m was less than h?
Why m was less than h? No, I'm not. I'm just assuming that that holds.
All right.
However, I want to emphasize that that doesn't, like, I don't have to assume a potential that of a free scalar field. I mean, the potential could be anything, just as long as the second derivative of the potential is small compared to the Hubble scale squared.
I just mean it's really hard to get that from the inflaton, right? So now you have another field that's also going to be much less.
Well, I mean, that's certainly model dependent. I agree with that.
Right.
But let's just assume that such fields exist. And right, so assume that the field was homogeneous during inflation, and let's see that how the distribution of field values for light fields evolved in time. And one can show by following the so-called stochastic approach developed by Starobinsky and Yokoyama in mid-90s, where you split the field into sub- and superhorizon parts and ask that how the superhorizon part evolves. And one can show that indeed the distribution, which at first was very homogeneous over some particular field value, here normalized to one Hubble scale, one can show that that develops this Gaussian form in the case of m squared phi squared potential. The y-axis here, indeed, is the probability distribution function, and the dashed line is the scalar field potential. So using this stochastic approach, it can be shown that the distribution of field values at the time when you'd reach this so-called equilibrium distribution during inflation takes indeed a Gaussian form for a field that has an m squared phi squared potential. N here is just a normalization factor guaranteeing total probability of unity when you integrate over all field values. And there's a relaxation time scale in which you reach this probability distribution function for fields in the Sitter space. That is, regardless of where such a light field was during inflation, in a time scale, N here is the number of E-folds, time scale of the order h squared over m squared, the field reaches that equilibrium distribution shown here. That happens regardless of what kind of field you have, an axion field, just a free scalar field, whatnot. Regardless of where it was placed, if it was light during inflation and inflation lasted long enough, then it reaches this equilibrium distribution state in this time scale shown here. Of course, if m was much, much smaller than the Hubble scale, that takes an enormous amount of time to reach that equilibrium distribution, but that's what's going to happen if indeed inflation lasted for long enough. And then we can ask that, well, what are the typical initial conditions for such fields when it comes to post-inflationary stages? And that is given by the variance of this probability distribution. We can argue that the typical displacement indeed is proportional to the variance computed from this probability distribution function, and it's of the order h to the fourth over m squared. So what I'm showing here is, or what all this means, is that in a patch, say the size of the horizon of the universe today, in such a patch, there were multiple patches, smaller patches, the size of the horizon at the end of inflation, and in each of those patches, the field took a value according to this distribution. And while the typical value was of this order, indeed, what you had was a whole distribution of field values. Yeah, questions there.
I wouldn't say the distribution is taking a level of patches of the Hubble radius.
It is. No, I mean, there's no reason for your coarse graining scale to be so large. Why would you say that?
Because every node that has crossed the Hubble radius is being straight, and the longest ones that left before are the ones that are dominating that configuration.
Yeah, and I mean, yes, that's right. They are dominating it. However, I mean, that doesn't mean that the field value wouldn't vary from patch to patch. More or less, yes, that's right.
I'm just saying, if it's lambda phi to the 4 we are talking about, if you compute the correlation of n, this is exponentially larger.
Depends on the value of lambda. Yes, however,
of course, it depends on lambda, but it's very sensitive to lambda.
It is. I agree with you on that. However, it depends on the value of lambda, and also I'm not talking about lambda phi to 4 theory here, but a potential which is m squared phi squared. Was there also another question?
Actually, this expression is valid for m squared phi squared.
Well, this is valid generally for
displacement.
Yeah, this one is for m squared phi squared. Yes, that's right.
But you don't have to restrict yourself to just free field.
That's right, yes, absolutely. Here I'm just discussing it for simplicity. Right. So at the end of inflation, there was a non-zero condensate of the scalar field such that its value varied from patch to patch, where patch here means a horizon volume, a volume determined by the size of the horizon at the end of inflation. And therefore, because the field was generically displaced from its minimum at the end of inflation, there was energy density stored in that field, and the energy density then varied as the field value did from patch to patch. It is a position-dependent quantity. And I would argue that this provides generic initial conditions for non-thermal dark matter models which also contain scalar fields. Consider freezing, for instance. Typically, people assume that there were no dark matter particles present when the freeze-in yield started, but that doesn't have to be the case. Like, if your hidden sector, where also dark matter belongs to, contains scalar fields, such scalar fields, if they were light during inflation, get excited, and they eventually will yield some energy density into that hidden sector as well. However, I'm not going to discuss that in this talk. Rather, I'm going to discuss dynamics of the scalar field of mine. What happens after inflation is that the field, when it becomes effectively massive after inflation, starts to oscillate about its minimum with an energy density that is scaling down as that of dark matter. Because indeed here I'm assuming that what I have is a free field. If the field did not decay, its present abundance is given by this following expression here. What is important here is just the mass scale of the scalar field and its initial value in a patch, the size of the horizon at the end of inflation. And because chi end, if we are concerned about the average energy density of this chi field today, then chi end here is determined by the variance of the probability distribution that I just showed to you, and therefore this model only has one parameter. If you choose m sufficiently, chi accounts for all dark matter, and that's it. This is arguably the simplest possible dark matter model. It's not very pretty, but on the other hand, it's based on very generic arguments, because this is what light scalar fields do during cosmic inflation. Right. Of course, I mean, this chi field does not have to be stable. Maybe it decayed into particles. Maybe those particles were not stable either, but at some point in that decay chain, if there are stable particles, their total energy density is finite and can be computed. For that, you obtain this expression here, where m is the mass of the scalar field, gamma is the effective decay width of the scalar field, and m psi is the mass of the particles that are stable. Of course, I mean, this doesn't have to be the way that dark matter is produced. Other sources, such as freezing, can contribute to the final dark matter abundance in this kind of scenarios too. Yes? Yeah, that's true.
And you previously gave the estimate of this was h of the fourth over m squared.
Correct.
So what does it say about h and m roughly?
Well, it turns out not to the not because fitting to the dark matter abundance, but because of isocurvature perturbations that I'm going to discuss in a minute, that h has to be of the order 10 to 8 GeV, that is 10 to minus 10 m Planck, if you want this field to constitutes all dark matter. I'm going to show you a figure in a minute. Right. Okay. So that's about inflation. Let's then discuss dark matter perturbations, because I noted that due to the fact that the field was fluctuating during inflation, and you developed this picture where at the end of inflation the field value varied from patch to patch, this chi energy, the energy density of this chi field is a position-dependent quantity. And then a crucial question is, do the perturbations in this chi field overlap with perturbations in radiation? That is, are the chi perturbations or dark matter perturbations, if you wish to produce the most of dark matter in this way, are the perturbations adiabatic or are they isocurvature perturbations?
What scale of perturbations are there?
What do you mean?
You don't care if they're isocurvature perturbations on really small scales, right?
That's true.
You only care about the ones that are 60 fold.
That's correct. I'm going to show you the power spectrum in a minute, because it can be computed exactly in this kind of models, which is pretty exciting. Right, so when it comes to isocurvature, it's defined as follows. Isocurvature between cold dark matter and radiation is simply the difference of the density contrasts, that is, perturbations in each of these species over the average energy density of these species, weighed by some equation of state-dependent factor. This quantity describes how much the cold dark matter perturbations differ from those in radiation. If S here vanishes, the perturbations are said to be adiabatic. If it doesn't, you have cold dark matter isocurvature. And even though it's really easy to produce cold dark matter isocurvature, it has never been observed, and therefore this non-observation of dark matter isocurvature places stringent constraints on this type of scenarios, that is, on dynamics of extrascalar fields during inflation. In particular, the observed peak structure of the CMB places constraints on dark matter isocurvature, usually expressed in the following way. The amplitude of isocurvature power spectrum at some chosen pivot scale, which is typically a very large distance scales, it has to be smaller than roughly 4% times the amplitude of the curvature power spectrum at that chosen pivot scale. It can be shown that light scalar fields in the sitter space generate an isocurvature power spectrum which obeys a power law so that it has its own amplitude and its own spectral tilt. Both can be computed in terms of the mass of the scalar field and the Hubble scale during inflation and take the following values, or can be expressed in the way shown here. The amplitude is exponentially small at large scales, and most interestingly and importantly, the spectral index will typically be, well, always be greater than 1, and therefore scalar fields, light scalar fields that acquired fluctuations during inflation develop a blue-tilted spectrum. Before discussing observational consequences of that, let me show you or answer to Mustafa's question regarding the scale of inflation that you need if you wanted this field chi to constitute all dark matter. You have to choose the amplitude and the spectral index here in such a way that you overcome or satisfy this isocurvature constraint, and that can only be done when M is of the order H, where you lie on this blue regime, and where, if in addition to that you wanted this field to constitute all dark matter, you have to lie on this red curve here, and in the regime where they overlap, that's the regime where the simplest kind of dark matter model works. The parameter space is not huge, but if you allowed the scalar field potential to contain also lambda phi to the fourth term, then of course your parameter space becomes much, much bigger. Right. But let's then discuss observational consequences. Testability of this kind of models, because in a way this is of course a nightmare scenario. I have a scalar field that doesn't couple to anything else. I can explain dark matter in this way and it's consistent with all observations, but I mean it's non-testable when it comes to direct detection or production of such scalar particles at the LHC, for instance. However, luckily dark matter isocurvature affects the curvature perturbation. It can be shown that the total curvature perturbation is given by a sum of the curvature perturbation that the inflaton field produces and the isocurvature part that dark matter generates. And because in this kind of scenarios, the dark matter isocurvature power spectrum is blue tilted, you can expect there to be more structure at small scales in this kind of models, due to the fact that the total curvature perturbation is the sum of these two components, the one produced by or generated by the inflaton field and the one generated by scalar fields, spectator fields that were present during inflation, and that also contribute significantly to the cold dark matter abundance. The purple curve here is the total curvature power spectrum. The red dotted line is the contribution of the inflaton field, which I'm here assuming to be red tilted, as it is observed to be at large scales, small k. And the black dashed line here is the contribution of the extrascalar field that I have in this scenario. So indeed, you can expect there to be more structure at small scales, and therefore you should expect the matter power spectrum to deviate from the adiabatic result, here shown by this black solid curve. The red dashed curve is the prediction of the model where a scalar field that acquired fluctuations during inflation is contributing to the cold dark matter abundance. In a way, you can call this, like, because of this, that you can expect there to be excess power at small scales, you can call this anti-warm dark matter, as Mark Kamiankowski put this. I'm now working on consequences of this together with Joe Silk and Mark Kamiankowski and other people at JHU, including Kim Bardi.
How can it differ in the VIO region? I mean, I thought that, I mean, the CMB really tightly constrained itself. So is this exaggerated, or is this?
Right, so what is shown here is the largest, the matter power spectrum in the case of largest isocurvature contribution allowed by the CMB.
I'm just surprised you can see it on this plot.
Yeah.
I believe.
But I mean, the CMB scales are here.
Well, the wiggles of the CMB,
right? Well, part of it, yeah, essentially, yes. That's right. However, this is only linear matter power spectrum, and I mean, when you go to scales as small as these, you shouldn't expect the linear result to hold anymore. So in fact, what you are going to need is n-body simulations.
Oh, sure. No, I was just commenting that I'm surprised that you can see the difference between the curves at the CMB. That's all. Just because the constraints are so tight there, but I mean, maybe I'm misreading.
Yeah, well, in fact, the curious thing is that actually blue-tilted gold dark matter isocurvature improves the CMB fits. This is something that, yeah, that's right. So not only this visible, but actually it fits better to observations than the pure adiabatic case. This is discussed in Planck papers as well. However, they don't make, they don't really emphasize this result, but you can find it there in a constraints on inflation paper, for instance. But yeah, indeed, it is visible at CMB scales as well. All right. So let me conclude. Inflation provides generic initial conditions for scalar fields when it comes to their post-inflationary dynamics. Such scalars can constitute all dark matter. And even though, in a way, this is something that you would call a nightmare scenario, I have argued that, in fact, it can be tested with observations of the large-scale structure as well as the CMB. That's all. Thank you.
Any questions? So I guess I have a question. So what's the difference between this and just what people used to call axion dark matter?
Ah, great, great, yeah.
Exactly the same?
No, this is not the same. And that is because axions, like if you assumed that inflation didn't last for so long, that axions, even though they were acquiring fluctuations during inflation, reached this equilibrium probability distribution that I showed to you, then the perturbation spectrum will be flat. However, here it's certainly not flat. This is the biggest difference compared to the axion case.
And that's just generated because you're assuming a cosine potential for the axion, so the fact that the axion potential opens up does that, or maybe?
No, it's because axions have generically a mass so small compared to the Hubble scale during inflation. But I mean, if you are willing to assume that inflation lasted for long enough, then certainly this should, a similar line of reasoning should apply to axions as well. And I think that when people assume in certain cases that axions produce a flat spectrum, that's actually not true. However, as far as I can tell, nobody has computed that yet, because the stochastic approach that I have used here doesn't apply as such to periodic potentials. You encounter some special problems with that. Let me put it in this way.
Sorry, just a comment on that. There's no pedals of the axion at all in inflation, because it's before the physics phase transition. So it's actually zero potential left.
Yeah, I mean, of course, if the potential was
zero for the axion at inflation. Well, you're assuming that inflation happened before QCD.
Okay, right. So you are talking about QCD axion. Yeah, right. I mean, if you have a flat potential. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're right with that. If you have had a flat potential, then certainly you will produce a flat spectrum. And that's one big difference compared to this case where I have a convex potential.
I thought you said that the mass had to be of the order of h for the model to satisfy the bounds. Is that correct?
Well, if you didn't have any other particles, if you only had this one scalar field and wanted that to constitute all dark matter, then m has to be of the order h, but still smaller than h, so that indeed you do acquire fluctuations. That's what gives you this. That's why m cannot be greater than h in this model.
So if it's of the order of h, then it's very flat, right, the spectrum?
No, on the contrary, it's not.
No?
No, because if m is of the order h, then it's very blue tilted.
Okay.
I'm just curious about the statement you say about the isocurvature gives the beta fit for the Planck result. So is that a statement about the dark matter isocurvature? Like you, okay, and it's not for this larger power spectrum thing. It's really just you turn on the dark matter isocurvature, and then let it flow, and then it gives the beta fit. Is that the statement?
Yeah, that's right. So when you have two extra parameters, the cold dark matter isocurvature amplitude and spectral index, when you let both of them float, then you get a better fit to the CMB than what the pure adiabatic case would give you.
Only slightly, though. It's also for more blue tilted, like for the, you say there's also NS there.
Yeah, that's right. If you don't let that vary, then the fit, I think, doesn't improve. At least that's what they discuss in Planck papers.
The result for the spectral index here, is this for pure de Sitter?
Yes.
So I guess I would have expected that for inflation, where the Hubble parameter is decreasing with time, even for a very light spectator, the power spectrum would be red, and that I'd have to get the Hubble parameter order Hubble or big, or the mass of the dark matter to be order Hubble or bigger until it tilts to blue. Is that a reasonable expectation?
I think that whether taking into account the fact that inflation has to end at some point gives you some slow roll suppressed corrections. But I don't think that it's going to change this result that if m indeed was of the order h, you should get blue tilted rather than red tilted.
Yeah, I'd expect that if m is order h, I would get blue. But I thought that this was sort of the motivation, one of the motivations for Wimpzilla's in the late 90s, that if the spectator mass were far below Hubble, like orders of magnitude below Hubble, I'd have problematic isocurvature at low scales. And by cranking the mass up towards and above Hubble, I tilt the spectrum to be blue, and then now I can get away with all of the dark matter being produced in this way without isocurvature problems.
I guess so. Yeah, that's right. However, I want to emphasize one thing. This is not one of those scenarios either, because I don't have a field here which is slowly rolling down in its potential and its mass being of the order h. So what I indeed have here is a whole distribution of field values. There's no mean field anywhere. whereas in those scenarios, you do have a mean field. And as a result of that, the power spectrum will be somewhat different than in those scenarios. Some factors here will be different.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about trying to pick up the signal on small scales. And you mentioned you'd have to do n-body. On those scales, wouldn't you even worry about baryons and whether you'd have to do hydro? Because, I mean,
Assume. So I'm by no means an expert on that, but unfortunately, yes, I think you are right with that. That we are talking about such small scales here that they may become important, yes.
And I mean, that's the biggest effect you'd expect, just because it's not like a dramatic...
Well, I mean, you can get a larger effect. However, as said, this is the largest amount of isocurvature allowed by the CMB. But if you are willing to be in some tension with the CMB, then you can get a larger effect.
But also because you're pinned down on the parameters, like this is the shape that's consistent with that. It's not that you have a lot of flexibility because your mass and everything's determined. Like this is the thing you're looking for. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's right.
I thought I understood that if you add couplings to the Ricci curvature, you can actually get rid of most of this. I thought this was actually, I learned this from your paper.
That's right.
If I couple it to the Ricci scalar, then you can just get rid of all the long wavelength fluctuations.
That's right.
And just generate things on really short distance scales. So generically, wouldn't you more likely to expect some scalar that doesn't have symmetries? Wouldn't you just expect renormalization, for example, to generate couplings to curvature, so isn't it sort of somehow more generic that...
Well, that all depends on the value of the non-minimal coupling. If it was small enough...
Well, but just even order one, right? Because the Ricci scalar is H squared, so then...
That's right. That's right. You need a non-minimal coupling parameter which is smaller than that. You're absolutely right with that.
Just to comment on what I was saying before about the correlation length, okay, because I arrived 5 minutes late to your talk. So actually what controls the correlation length is really the ratio of the mass to the Hubble scale. And in your model, what you are saying essentially is the mass is of the order of the Hubble scale. Therefore, I completely agree with you that the distribution of fields is in Hubble radius order of size Hubble radius patches.
But if
there had been a big separation, it would be really exponentially separated, the correlation length.
I agree. Okay. Yes, that's right. And in the case of lambda phi to the fourth potential, if you wanted that field to constitute all dark matter, field that acquired fluctuations in lambda phi to the fourth potential during inflation, and then oscillates about a quadratic minimum today, if you wanted that to constitute all dark matter, you need lambda of the order 0.1. In order to satisfy the isocurvature limits. And in that case, then, the correlation length will be small. Isn't that right? If lambda was of the order 0.1 rather than 10 to minus 3.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I brought up lambda phi to the 4 is just because I know by heart the numbers. But for lambda 0.1, you are right. I think the correlation length would be of the order of Hubble scale already.
Yeah.
And for your case of a free massive field, essentially, it's controlled by the ratio of mass to the Hubble rate, which in your case is of the order 1. So it's totally fine what you were saying. Just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, so I just wanted to ask about the expression of the isocurvature, A iso. Is that what you said you calculated based on the stochastic approach?
Yes.
So N is like a resumming all the log wave correction, or E to... E-folding is like resumming all the log wave corrections. So.
Sorry, say again.
Well, that so last part, in the previous slide, you were showing that based on this probability distribution, chi-square was basically that it can be determined when the potential becomes h to the fourth. And the expression seems to be a little bit different from that. And so this structure of E to minus N appears by resumming log wave.
You mean this one here?
Yeah.
No, it just comes from the choice of the pivot scale. Because, I mean, you can compute that how large the fluctuations are at, what's the field value, the distribution of field values at the end of inflation. However, if you are interested in a patch or modes that are inside the horizon at the end of inflation, they are very small compared to the pivot scale here. Pivot scale is huge compared to those scales and of the order, almost of the order of the horizon today. So that's what gives me this e to minus 2n here.
But that's basically consistent with what you described before using this probability distribution.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, if you choose k star to be a scale that was inside the horizon at the end of inflation, then n is, of course, zero. And then you get the amplitude, which should be of the order of typical size of fluctuations at the end of inflation.
Any more questions? Well, if not, then let's thank Tommy once again.
Thanks.